From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in July of 2016 with the passing of a man who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Elie Wiesel is best known as the author of Night, a book based on his experiences as a Jewish prisoner in concentration camps. Wiesel was, of course, a Holocaust survivor whose works are taught in countless classrooms. And given what you know about Elie Wiesel, you might assume that he was a stern, quiet, contemplative figure in his personal life. And yet, Rabbi Ariel Berger says that one of the defining aspects of Elie Wiesel was joy. Rabbi Berger is the author of Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. He got to know Wiesel when the author was in his 60s, and they became close. Berger's book details the wisdom that Wiesel shared and the impact it can have on faith and our collective humanity. Wiesel never stopped thinking about questions that can be painful, especially in regard to human suffering. Whether it's the Holocaust or other atrocities, we might ask, how could God allow this? Or we might ask, how could our fellow humans allow this? There is a lot to talk about here. Rabbi Berger is coming to Rochester as part of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival, which is going on now. He'll be here tomorrow night. But first, he's with us on the line as our guest on Connections. Rabbi Berger, it's our honor. How are you, sir?
Hi, Evan. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm excited to come to Rochester.
Yes, tomorrow night, it's 7:30 at the JCC. We say hello in studio to Stacy Fried, who's co-chair of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. I think it'll be really great for people.
Yeah, we'll talk in a moment about what's coming up tomorrow. Hello as well to Barbara Applebaum, who's a book festival volunteer and has only read Witness twice, she was telling me. Welcome to you as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm introducing you, Ariel, tomorrow night.
Wonderful.
Tomorrow night, 7:30. And Stacy was mentioning before the program began here that this is a free event. However, people need to know what, Stacy?
They need to buy tickets. They need to just order some tickets. And you can do that by dialing 461-2000 and call people at the JCC, or you can go to rjbf.org for Rochester Jewish Book Festival.org.
All right. So 461-2000 if you want to call and reserve your place, because it's free, but they do expect to fill up at 7:30 at the JCC tomorrow night. Rabbi Berger, I just want to start with just a little bit of background for our listeners here, because, depending on what our listeners read in their various classrooms growing up, depending on our listeners' own backgrounds, they may know a lot about Elie Wiesel. They may know not nearly as much as others. And as I mentioned at the outset, he's best known for Night, but he wrote, 40-plus books. Yet you always refer to him as a teacher, first of all. I guess that's how he referred to himself, didn't he?
Yes, yes. Whenever he was asked, what is your life about? What is your role in the world? He always said, I'm a teacher. Sometimes he also said, I'm a writer. But my writing, he said, is my teaching, and my teaching is connected to my writing. And he believed so deeply in the power of education that it drove everything else that he did, his activism, his testimony about the Holocaust, his work on behalf of human rights around the world. Everything he did was rooted in his love of learning and his love of teaching.
You got to know him, well, I would say get to know him is different than meeting him, but it goes back to when you were, 15 years old?
15 years old, yeah.
Tell us the story.
So I met him after a lecture in New York. I was introduced to him, and it was in a small reception room next to the large lecture hall. He had just completed a lecture to, I think it was something like 1,200 people. And he, of course, this is 1990. This is 4 years after he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's a very well-known person, a celebrity, and I'm a kid. And he holds his hand out to me, and he says his name as if I have no idea who he is, with tremendous humility. And then he said something that changed my life, although I didn't know it at the time. He said, come see me and bring a question. And so I did. It took me a little while to build the courage to actually go visit him, but I did, and I brought him several questions, actually. And that was the beginning of a lifelong relationship.
In fact, he was willing to wait to build that relationship because you were on your own sort of journey. And tell us a little bit about your own journey before you started developing this relationship with Elie Wiesel.
Well, I was involved in different parts of human and Jewish life. I was going to a very Orthodox school as a child, and I was also very involved in the arts. And so I was the kid in the corner of the classroom who was always doodling in the sacred text that we were studying. And the doodles and the drawings were taking over the pages as the year went on. And I had a lot of questions about the relationship between religious life and spiritual life on the one hand, with its demands and its disciplines, and the life of an artist, which is all about freedom and a certain kind of wildness on the other. And so I went back and forth between different places of study here in the States and also in Israel to dive really deeply into Jewish text and my own tradition, and especially the mystical teachings of my tradition, which talk about creativity. And Elie Wiesel was the person I went to with my questions about how to bring all those things together.
Well, and you know, I mentioned at the outset a couple of questions I do want to delve into, and I don't want to be trite about it, but I think it feels like in the last several years, more than ever, we are at this point where we're wondering, how could our fellow humans allow this? Not just the question of how could God allow this, but how could our fellow humans allow this? When we see what happened in Pittsburgh, when we see the kind of hateful incidents that still characterize so much of not just the discourse, but human action. And we'll get to that as we go throughout the hour with Rabbi Berger, because I know those were central questions, not just for us, but for Elie Wiesel. Though as we talk about these, as I said, stern topics, you want him remembered as someone who was joyful, don't you?
Well, I want him remembered as someone who had tremendous emotional range. He was capable of great intensity. He was carrying questions, including the questions you're asking, that are enduring, very difficult, very profound questions that might not even have answers. They might only have responses. And so there were moments of great seriousness and intensity in the classroom, but there were also great moments of joy and humor. And sometimes when he felt that words and language were failing us, he stopped speaking and he started to sing songs of his childhood. So there was a real range there, a very whole, multifaceted person.
So I want to ask you if you could just describe what that classroom was like. You've started to do it, but for someone like you, had a chance to meet with them essentially every week, and to witness him in this way, what was that classroom like? What do you remember most from it?
Well, so first of all, it was in Boston, at Boston University, where he taught for almost 40 years. He lived in New York, and he would fly to Boston every week to teach, and teach over the course of 2 days, and then fly back. And sometimes he had to fly to Paris or Oslo or Jerusalem or somewhere else. And on occasion, he would fly to Paris and then fly back to Boston within 30 hours so that he could come back to teach his class. He was very dedicated to his students. It was a class full of students from around the world and of many ages. There were undergraduate students and graduate students and retirees who were taking his courses for pleasure and enrichment. So it was a very kind of unique setting where people brought questions from their own personal experiences. And he would stand at the front of the room. There was a large, long table. He stood at the side of the table, not the head of the table. And the students would sit in rows around that table, and he would speak very quietly. Everyone would lean forward to hear him. He refused to use a microphone. He didn't want any distance or space between him and the students. And the conversation was always about a book, a great work of literature, usually a novel or a play, from ancient times or modern literature, from all kinds of geographic places and traditions and cultures. And he would unpack, in a kind of Socratic seminar, he would unpack the themes of these works with questions and answers and conversations with students. And it was always driven by the question of how does this work of literature humanize us? How does it teach us about our moral and ethical responsibilities?
If I could, I'd like to read a little bit from one of the sections, well, frankly, from one of the moments that in that classroom that might illustrate some of what you're talking about, if I could. So this comes from a section headlined, "We are here to learn together interreligious dialogue." And I'll read now from Rabbi Berger's book, in which case it's a part of the class that Rabbi Berger says that he said he didn't expect the conversation to become heated, but the class setting is just as he described here, people from different backgrounds, different all over the world. And so here's what Rabbi Berger writes in a class in which he was describing the 18th century Hasidic movement and the origins, the roots. Quote, he speaks in a low voice and seems to be focused on a distant place. Does Hasidism recognize change? Yes, And no, the movement itself changed. It was at first revolutionary. Then, as a result of its encounter with modernity, it became very conservative. In reaction to modernity, the communities of mystical imagination closed ranks, becoming fearful of the outside world, suspicious of anything not found in the old texts. From its origins until the later masters, Hasidism is totally different. Why? Because the world changed. Today, it's not easy to be a mystic. And then he turns his attention back to the class. We are discussing a Jewish religious movement. How do you Christians feel here, reading these tales, learning this history? Olivia, a grad student from Poland who has already fallen in love with all things mystical, sighs and says, I feel I found a truth I've been looking for, a gift. A theology student, Matt, says, so much of this reminds me of Jesus, the charismatic leaders, their suffering on behalf of others. An Orthodox woman, Chaya, is offended. I don't like when people make that comparison. I come from a Hasidic family. Where do you think Jesus got his ideas? From Judaism. A fierce debate ensues about whether it is legitimate to describe one religion, one truth, using the language of another. Isn't it messy to mix and match intellectual frameworks, to use modern psychological concepts to describe pre-modern experiences of suffering, for example? And yet, don't those modern scientific categories help illuminate those experiences and bring them closer to us? I could go on, Rabbi Berger, but I think that this is an interesting moment where you have an unexpected heat, but to me that stands out for what interreligious dialogue probably should look like. Mm. Not just learning history, but sort of debating different aspects of it. How do you feel Wiesel thought we were doing with interreligious dialogue, generally speaking, as a society, and how did he try to foster that in class?
Well, that was such a great moment in the classroom. I was taken aback by his willingness to call out a specific group and invite them to share their perspective and to embrace and be hospitable to that kind of conflict. And because the setting was so deeply respectful and safe, and that safety had been designed and set up over weeks, I think we were able to go there as a class. We were able to get into the nitty-gritty questions of difference and disagreement. And it could get heated because people felt that we're not going to explode. We're not going to fall apart. No one's going to have to leave in a huff. And so there was a vessel for that kind of conversation. And I think that was really important to Professor Wiesel, that we find ways of encountering, as he would often say, encountering the otherness of the other, which means not to just focus on what we have in common, but to embrace the differences and to recognize that if we approach one another with deep respect and even a sense of reverence for one another and one another's traditions and life experiences, that even though your experience might be different than mine and challenging to my own understanding of the world, if I approach you with deep respect and respect that I cultivate and learn how to build in myself, then we can surface and unearth and reveal some really cool, interesting differences from which we can all learn. So he believed in that very deeply. He spoke about the interreligious dialogue process between Jews and Christians that was that preceded and led to Vatican II, the process of the Church reevaluating some of its positions on the Jewish people, on Christian anti-Semitism, and other issues as well. And he bemoaned the absence of Islamic scholars in that process. We realized in retrospect we should have included Islamic scholars and Muslim leaders as well in that process in the 60s. And so he talked to us often about what it might look like to have an interreligious dialogue that's not just between two groups, but between multiple groups in an environment of deep respect and with a fearlessness about encountering one another honestly.
If I could, I'm going to just read a little bit more as the class goes on that day, because what the class then is doing is confronting stereotype, frankly. And let's hit that, because I think as we look at anti-Semitism, as we look at hate, as we look, we have this surface level understanding, and sometimes the idea of chosen people or chosen ones comes up, and for non-Jewish people, especially for people who are anti-Semitic, it carries this idea of condescension. And this is where the dialogue, I think it's really interesting on that point. So I'm going to go ahead and continue to read from that. And it's in a section in which the professor is talking about old teachings in which good Christians would be good and trustworthy. And so I'll quote now. "Really?" asks Park, a Christian minister in training. "But don't Jews put their own people first? Isn't that what the notion of the chosen people means?" There is a pause. Then Chaya sits up in her seat and says, "I cannot believe you said that. That's such a stereotype." "Wait," says Professor Wiesel. "We are here to learn together, and we must listen. How else are we to change others' minds or our own?" And then he turns back to Park. "The notion of chosenness," he explains, "surely has caused some Jews to fall into the trap of triumphalism. Yet, with one short-lived exception, the Jewish people never tried to proselytize, and Jews did not force others to convert. Just the opposite. They dissuade others from joining them. When someone comes to us wanting to become a Jew, we say, 'Why would you want that? Don't you know that we are the most persecuted people on earth, that we have never had a single generation free of attack?' For a Jew to be human is to be Jewish. My humanity is expressed through my story, my roots, my tradition. It is the same thing for others. For a Christian to be human is to be Christian. For a Muslim to be human is to be Muslim. For a Buddhist to be human is to be Buddhist. To claim that one path is better than another, to denigrate others, has an almost inevitable outcome: dehumanization." End quote. Very different, Rabbi, than the stereotype about chosen people or chosen ones.
Yeah, and I must tell you, this section that you're reading is from a chapter about otherness and conflict and difference. And when I first started writing the book, I thought that that chapter would come somewhere late in the book. And because of what was happening around us in the world, I felt that it had to come earlier, and I moved it to become the second chapter, to kind of establish the ground rules that we're going to discuss a lot of different topics. And I want the reader to know that Professor Wiesel is a master of creating a space in which those kinds of dialogues can happen, where an honest acknowledgement of difficult texts or difficult ideas that have caused a lot of damage and harm can be spoken aloud, where we can reevaluate and reexamine our own assumptions about one another and about ourselves. Because that sets us up then to be able to discuss other difficult topics as well. So it's sort of a bedrock first principle of Professor Wiesel's approach to teaching and learning.
I also chose that section because I think it's important, and as I turn to our guests in studio, to point out that that Witness isn't really a book just for Jewish audiences. I mean, these are themes that so many people wrestle with, whether you're a person of faith or not. And I'll ask Barbara first, how do you feel about that?
Yes, absolutely. And today, more than ever, as we try to teach the Holocaust, when I was in charge of the Holocaust Center and working with teachers in running, bringing survivors into the classroom, we had to make people aware that this is not a Jewish thing. That and they felt that. As a matter of fact, some of our most welcoming classrooms were in the Catholic parochial schools, because they understood suffering and they embraced the survivors and made them feel so welcome. In teaching the Holocaust, I think that we need to make it an impact to make the students know to connect with that, to face themselves and to face others, and to be an advocate for the suffering of others.
I'll ask Stacy on the same subject to weigh in. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's the famous poem, and now the writer of that escapes me, but, you know, first they came for the Jews, and then they came for the communists, and then so it really is something that everybody should have an interest in terms of history, in terms of how we move forward. You know, how do we educate each other on being compassionate to one another and trying to understand one another? I think that, you know, reading this kind of a book or listening to Rabbi Berger helps us take a look at ourselves and helps us ask the right questions going forward.
So, Rabbi, if I could, as we look at this, the subject of otherness, as you write, and felt compelled to sort of move up in your book for obvious reasons, given what we are seeing here in our country and around the world, there are competing ideas, I think, that people have in response to some of this. One of them is despair, outright despair, a feeling that there is some sort of inevitability to our conflict and division. And then maybe on the other end of that, as you have talked about in regards to Elie Wiesel, is the idea of that competing despair with complacency, this idea that you're either willing to kind of accept everything without working to change. But I would also couple that with this idea of maybe sort of withdrawing, almost feeling like the safest or best thing to do would be to withdraw from society. That's actually what Rod Dreher, who is written about sort of Orthodox Christianity and the idea of creating these mini micro societies that in which these societies can withdraw from the larger society, bring their own values, and live largely self-sufficiently among one another without having to quarrel or deal with the outside strife. And so can you kind of give me those the ends of those coins of despair and complacency, and maybe how you view that and how Elie Wiesel viewed that, especially, and maybe how you think that would be viewed in light of these modern struggles that we're having?
Yeah, it's a great way to frame this conversation and this question. I think about it a lot. I think that if we look seriously at human history and we look at what's happening today, we would be foolish not to at least be tempted by despair. It's a natural reaction to reading history and realizing, as Elie Wiesel did, that even after Auschwitz, there are other instances of genocide and war and oppression and unnecessary suffering caused by human beings. To this day, it's happening today. And if you really take that seriously, which we should look at that and not turn away from that suffering, despair comes up as an important topic. And so we're not looking for a kind of light, superficial, avoidant hope or optimism. And we're certainly not looking for a model of people hunkering down and binge-watching stuff because, you know, if we all do that, then nothing is really going to change. And so Professor Wiesel's approach was you have to feel the temptation, the pull of despair when you realize that the world has not really changed in the ways that we hoped it would, we thought it would after the Holocaust, we always, throughout human history, were hoping for, are still hoping for. But then there's another step that he offered us, which is to choose hope as a moral choice. In spite of all the evidence, in spite of the logical reasons for hoping, if you choose to hope, you're making a moral choice to stay in the world and to play a role in making the world better. And so it's a complicated multi-step process because I think where it begins for many of us is when something pops up on my social media feed that's difficult to look at, there's a temptation to look away just for self-preservation. I don't want to see people suffering, hungry children in Yemen or Kurds under assault or people turned away at the border or put in cages. I mean, it's not something I want to bring into my life because I need to just take care of myself and maintain my own balance and sense of joy and feeling okay. And there's enough stuff to worry about on a daily basis in most of our lives. And so the first temptation to overcome is that the temptation of looking away. And when we do that, when we overcome that temptation and we look and we continue to look and we take seriously the suffering of other people, and maybe we don't sleep so well at night because we're aware that people are suffering, that's when despair comes up. And that's the second temptation. And that's when we have to say, in spite of all of this, I'm not looking away, and I'm also not choosing to despair. I'm choosing hope, and I'm choosing an active hope, not a quiet hope, a quietism, where I'm hoping that someone else is going to swoop in and save the day or God is going to save the day, but that realizing that my hope is active and I am the expression, I'm the messenger who was sent to my time and place in my own modest scope of my life to make the world a little bit better every day. And I need to ask myself when I wake up in the morning, how am I doing that today?
Well, But what about this argument that retreating is actually logical at this point? And again, it's been a couple of years since I spent some time with Rod Dreher's book called The Benedict Option, but just reading from some notes on what he is arguing in that book, he essentially says that the way forward for true spiritual believers is to sort of go back many, many centuries. For him, it was all the way back to St. Benedict of Nursia. And that was a 6th century monk who was, distraught over moral chaos as he saw it, and actually went out into the forest and created this new way of life for Christians, and then built these communities. And the idea that Dreher has now is that for now, at least, we can sort of retreat into our own way, maybe not literally into the forest, but into these communities that we can create and be insular. Now, maybe Rod Dreher and his acolytes would call me and say, you're misreading something here. But the larger point, I think, is that despair may lead people to want to withdraw and to say that the moral choice is to do that, that if we can't, quote unquote, save the wider world, that we can create the best community we can for those we love in smaller, more closed off spaces. What do you say to that, Rabbi?
I wrote an essay about this because I was wrestling with this myself. I think, first of all, we have the same movement in certain periods in Jewish history. Maimonides, the great 12th century philosopher, talks about this, that when society is corrupt, sometimes you have to just leave society and move out into the desert, into the wilderness. And we have movements and individual spiritual seekers who lived in isolation. It's not a mainstream general Jewish approach because Judaism is so much about family, but we do have examples of that. And I understand the impulse, and that impulse also appears in a very, very different form with much less, I think, much less intentionality and depth in terms of social media and echo chambers. It's a similar or parallel impulse, not to conflate the two. Again, it doesn't have the same level at all of discipline and depth, but we want to be surrounded by people who reinforce our values, and that makes sense in a certain way. Some of the Hasidic masters, some of the Jewish mystical masters, created a kind of integration of that monastic impulse with staying in the world. And I try to practice that in certain ways in my life, where they said, you should be a monk or a monastic for an hour a day, or for half an hour a day. You should find a regular time where you're able to retreat from society, have a quiet space in nature or in a room where you can lock the door, and you can really take stock of your own life and the world around you, unencumbered by the noise of the world around you. So the secret to this, of course, is don't bring your phone into that room. but really find a way to be alone and practice that solitude where you can get some perspective and you can come back to your center, your true values, free of the world's influences, but do it in a smaller way, a modest way, so that you can then rejoin the world and try to act to make things better. And that movement back and forth between solitude and action, solitude and activism, I think is really, really important for us to consider.
Talking to Rabbi Ariel Berger, who is the author of Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. And Rabbi Berger is coming to Rochester tomorrow night. It's part of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival, which is happening now. And the event tomorrow is at 7:30 at the JCC. They would love to see you there. The event is free, but if you just show up without letting them know you're coming, you may not get in. So after our only break of the hour, we'll come back and tell you how you can make sure that you have a free pass or ticket to the event tomorrow night. And there's a lot of other things happening as well. So Rabbi Berger is with us. Stacy Fried and Barbara Applebaum, representing the book festival, are here with us in studio. And we'll also talk about that theme that we touched on at the outset here. How does Rabbi Berger think about the question, how could God allow this to happen? We'll talk about that coming up. Coming up in our second hour, we're reading books less often than we used to, so maybe the future in our short attention span society is short stories. If that sounds cynical, short story collections saw a surge in sales recently, and we're going to talk to some writers about their fascinating works. We've really enjoyed their short stories. We'll get a sense for what your reading habits are as we look at the future of literature next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. First of all, Stacy Fried, co-chair of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. If people want to come out tomorrow night, Tuesday night at the JCC at 7:30, to meet and hear Rabbi Ariel Berger talk about his book, Witness. They can do that, and I know it's free, but you got to have them reserve in advance, or how do they do that?
Yes. You just go to rjbf.org or call 461-2000, and you'll get your tickets.
RJBF is Rochester Jewish Book Festival, rjbf.org. What else is on your list? You doing anything else besides Rabbi Berger? Is that
Oh,
it?
Yeah.
Oh, there is. It's a festival. What else
yes,
is on the list there that
festival.
You're excited about?
Well, it's interesting that when we were talking to Rabbi Berger, he mentioned something about the echo chamber, because tonight we have Jonathan Weissman, who is the author of Semitism, which is in three parentheses on either side, which is that representation of the echo chamber that the alt-right has been using to point the finger at who might be a Jewish writer or intellectual. And so Jonathan Weissman is very important. He'll be talking to us about being Jewish in America in the age of Trump and in this echo chamber and what's happening with the alt-right. And then later on, November 6th and 7th, there's 48 Hours of Food, because what's a Jewish festival without food? We have Hani Apfelbaum, who wrote Millennial Kosher. She's on Instagram with Busy in Brooklyn, an amazing woman. And then we've got the two people who own Zahav Restaurant in Philadelphia, which has been named James Beard Awards Best Restaurant in America. And they'll be talking to us about their new book, Israeli Soul. And there will be lots of goodies for tasting, lots of great food. There's a luncheon with Dr. Michael Roizen, who had been with Dr. Oz. And he'll be there during the week. Aside from food, there's also going to be a great day for kids on Sunday called Marvelous Day, where we celebrate all things Marvel. So bring out your little superheroes at the JCC from 2 to 4 on Sunday the 10th. Judith Viorst is going to be there on Monday the 11th. And we'll also have a fiction panel on Friday the 10th with three historical fiction novelists. And then on into next week, on Tuesday the 12th, we'll have a best-selling New York Times best-selling author, Julie Oringer, with her book Flight Portfolio, which is about Varian Fry, who helped Jews escape and anti-Nazis escape the war from Marseille. And it turns out that Varian Fry's son, Jim Fry, is a professor of biology at the University of Rochester. So there may be some surprises at Julie Oringer's talk.
All right. Whole schedule for you at rjbf.org if you'd like to check that out. I want to return to a subject that that Barbara mentioned briefly, and I want you to kind of expand your thoughts on what it means for the creation of a safe place to explore these concepts, these ideas, these dialogues. I do, yeah, Barbara, your thought, and then we'll turn back to Rabbi Berger for this. Because as I read about the way Elie Wiesel conducted these moments, these classes, these conversations, these explorations, I feel like there's a lesson for a lot of us who are now immersed in this culture of point scoring. How many likes do you get for a tweet? How many retweets do you get? Did you take somebody down? As opposed to, did you actually engage in a way that creates further understanding? And tell me how you took the idea of creating that safe place, Barbara.
I would bring Holocaust survivors into the classroom in Rochester, and they would, by their testimony, create a safe space. There was some kind of magic in the room when they spoke about their experiences during the war and the loss of family, and they were the same ages. This is mostly middle school and junior high school and high school classes, and they would talk about the that they experienced as a young person things they never thought they could handle, and that they were able to survive and live through it and create families. And during the discussion period after their testimony, the students would share their issues and look to the survivor as a role model. And today, we have some survivors that still go into the classroom, and they're amazing, but they were children, and so they're telling their parents' story. But still, that is going to be a challenge now. To teach about the sensitive issue of the Holocaust puts tremendous burden on
the teacher to get that kind of safe space of a Holocaust survivor testimony. There is a website that's being developed with most of the survivors have left us, and there is a website being developed called RochesterHolocaustSurvivors.org that will allow people to bring the all the testimony that was done over 30 years of the Rochester survivors, including those done by Spielberg. And what they will be able to do is to use those testimonies in the classroom. I found that the teachers that asked for the survivor to come into the classroom were extraordinary, and they became friends of mine. They were the ones who had either had been exposed to Anne Frank, and most students had been exposed to Anne Frank, and had taught it very, very sensitively and wanted to have that witness in the classroom. It was, you know, for some of them a big step, but they were able to engage students, and it reverberated for other things that they were teaching.
So Rabbi Berger, what Barbara is talking about there, I want to put a point on one important aspect of this, because sometimes the modern invocation of the term safe space is lampooned by those who think that it means that whoever needs the safe space cannot handle anything that challenges them, that could be difficult, that might be emotional. What Barbara is describing, and frankly, I think what I was reading about the work that Elie Wiesel have done, is to create a safe space not to be shielded entirely from challenge, but to say, you can be safe in expressing your questions. You can be safe to be wrong. You can be safe to share your doubts or your own views. And we can be safe to engage in a way that is respectful, that is going to seek to explore this. That's different than the stereotype of safe space that I often hear. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Yeah, it's very, very different. And I appreciate hearing Barbara's description of what happened in those classrooms. It's so important. And what scares me about the kind of avoidant approach, which tries to really exclude anything controversial from these conversations or from classrooms, is that the questions that we need to be asking, the questions about moral and ethical behavior, why do human beings behave in the ways they do, why is there still war and violence in the world, and so on and so on, these are large and enduring questions that I don't think human beings can answer in a single lifetime. I think that we need to look back at great thinkers who wrestled with these questions, at least to see what was tried and didn't work, so we can make some progress and avoid repeating earlier false solutions. And that means that the questions are so big that we need to live in those questions without being guaranteed of any answers. And in order to do that, we need to be willing to say, I am going to not know something, and I'm going to take my I don't know and put it in dialogue with your I don't know, and let's explore together and let's see what happens. And that requires a great deal of courage. And the safe space that I write about in the book and that Professor Wiesel created was, how do you design an environment in which that kind of courage is easier, is more likely to happen? How do you create an environment of deep respect where, as you said, my question, even if it sounds like a stupid question, will be respected and won't be rejected out of hand? And if I say something that sounds misguided or mistaken, I won't be shamed for it. I won't be laughed at or kicked out of the room. People will inquire more deeply into what am I really asking, what's underneath my question. There's room for that kind of dialogue. There's room for that kind of empathy. And there were two other important elements, I think, to note here in what Barbara said and also in what Professor Wiesel did as a teacher. One is to celebrate questions and to welcome questions, even if they don't have answers that are clear to us, which we've talked about. And the other is to really celebrate stories and to shift the conversations that we have from policy-oriented conversations only, where we're arguing about what's the right solution to a problem, mm-hmm. to making room for stories, because it's harder to argue with a story. I've seen people do it. It seems sort of silly, but I've seen people say that story doesn't make sense to me. But it's much more difficult to argue with someone's subjective experience, someone's story. And so encountering those stories, whether it's the stories of survivors or others, is really, really important. It opens us up to ideas that can inhabit us, can change us, can sensitize us, stories that we can carry with us as we go forward in life, in a way that policy discussions and disagreements about solutions can't really get us to.
So my guest is Rabbi Ariel Berger, who is the author of Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. And he is coming to Rochester as part of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival tomorrow night. His book is about his experience getting to know, being alongside the great Elie Wiesel, who died in 2016 at the age of 87. Wiesel, of course, was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, author of more than 40 books, including Night and A Holocaust Survivor. And so before we kind of turn to some theological questions, kind of end the hour, I do want to ask you, Rabbi Berger, and this is not intentionally at all political, but I did observe, it was interesting to observe the way President Obama sort of waded into a national conversation about the way we talk to each other last week. And he essentially was saying that he's not a big fan of what he would probably call cancel culture or purity tests. Mm-hmm. And I'm contrasting this with someone like Elie Wiesel, who was wrestling with big questions his entire lifetime, knowing that people change, they experience different things. As you talk about stories, your story is different than mine, it's different than Barbara's, it's different than Stacy's. And that understanding takes dialogue, it takes exploration, it takes the safe space to respect and share, as opposed to this point scoring, you're not, in the sort of circle of what we might call wokeness and you're canceled. Does that modern online sort of high velocity point scoring fly in contrast to what Elie Wiesel was trying to do, do you think, Rabbi?
I think it very much does. And it's a certain, I mean, anytime we have a kind of tyrannical approach where if you say certain things, you're immediately invalid as a person, that kind of intellectual McCarthyism, whether it comes from the right or the left, is ultimately counterproductive, and it stops us from growing together. And if there's one thing we know right now, today, it's that we need to grow. We need to grow as a society. We need to grow as a human species. We need to explore and examine things, because we need better approaches and better solutions. So why would we want to short-circuit that process? Why wouldn't we want to create environments in which that kind of exploration and real creative thinking can happen?
So as we get ready to wrap the hour, Elie Wiesel was the kind of person who would often think about how could God allow this? And it would be natural for anybody who experienced what he experienced in his life, surviving the Holocaust, to rethink spirituality, to rethink a world in which there is a creating God who is going to allow this kind of suffering and mass murder. Where do you start with that, and where did Elie Wiesel start with that?
Well, for him, it really started with his childhood, which if you read Night, you know that he was a very religious boy, filled with fervor and a kind of religious imagination. And he spent a lot of his time as a child through his deportation with his family to the concentration camps, living a religious, mystical Jewish life as much as is possible for a young boy. And in a way that's very countercultural and atypical. He was involved in mystical studies, and he would pray for the coming of the Messiah to redeem the entire world. And while the other kids were playing ball outside, that's what he was doing. So he had a very kind of naive and very profound faith that was shattered by encounter with the Holocaust, what he called the Kingdom of Night, where all the rules of morality and ethics seemed to be suspended, where God seemed to be absent or even worse, implicated in what was happening. And he had experiences in the camps that shaped him for the rest of his life, including a moment when he saw four old rabbis put God on trial for what was happening. And they had a 3-day trial of God with prosecutors and defense lawyers and arguments for and against God's guilt in allowing this suffering to happen to the Jewish people. And in the end, they found God guilty. And after they found God guilty, they announced the verdict. They said, okay, now it's time to pray the evening prayer, which means that you're able to, there's a pathway, there's an approach which says you're allowed to ask questions, you're allowed to demand accountability of God, and you're allowed to even find God guilty of certain moral sins. And at the same time, you can stay within the tradition, and you can stay within traditional practice, and you can stay in dialogue with God. There are Jewish roots to that idea in the Bible and elsewhere. It's not a completely new idea in Judaism, but Elie Wiesel took that and developed what he called a wounded faith, an approach to faith that allowed for those questions, where the opposite of faith is no longer doubt or questions. The opposite of faith is complete disengagement. And he rejected that. He stayed engaged in religious life and religious questions. He honored the paths of his ancestors, and he stayed connected to Jewish tradition. But he asked those questions. He argued with God. He wrestled with God for his entire life. And he said once in class, when it comes time to leave the world, I'm going to ask God one question. And students said, what's the question, professor? He said, why?
I feel so inept here. Why what, Rabbi?
I think he was a living embodiment of that existential question. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. Why are we here, and why does suffering happen? Mm-hmm. And all the questions that we're not able to answer.
All kind of wrapped up there, huh?
Yeah, all kind of wrapped up, and not just spoken, but somehow lived in every fiber of his being. He modeled for us that it's possible to live with those questions and to still celebrate life and to be a joyous person, but not to allow those questions to be resolved by superficial, quick answers.
Fair enough. So you've done, I think, a remarkable job bringing us the spirit of the man that you loved and you spent all this time with. So let me ask how you, Rabbi Berger, would answer that question from someone who says, I have abandoned my faith because I see children with cancer, I see starvation, I see the kind of inequality in which a truly omnipotent, omniscient deity might create free will, might create all kinds of avenues for different possibilities within that life experience, but would never tolerate this level of pain. And yeah. My only conclusion is, we are alone without a deity. What do you say to that, Rabbi?
Well, you know, from a Jewish perspective, our beliefs matter much less than our actions. And so it's difficult for a traditional Jewish rabbi to get judgy about people's theological positions. Because really, there are two ways of living with that question, the way you're articulating it. One is, I'm encountering suffering, and so I'm rejecting the idea that God exists. And as part of that, I'm also kind of shutting down. I'm becoming a more armored person. I'm becoming jaded, disengaged, cynical, and I'm going to live the rest of my life avoiding suffering and avoiding the encounter with suffering. And I think that is a moral mistake, not just a religious or spiritual one. I think it's a moral mistake. But it's also possible, and we have many examples of this in many religious traditions, of people who encounter that experience of suffering, and they come to a conclusion, but it's not an answer, it's a question. It's the beginning of a quest. And someone who encounters the same suffering and is so pained by it can be broken open to a kind of tenderness and a kind of quest and seeking and commitment to a search that can drive them for the rest of their life to study, to try to make the world better in small ways and bigger ways, and to become a messenger of tenderness and a messenger of kindness and compassion. And they also don't believe in God. They've also rejected the idea intellectually that there could possibly be an omnipotent God. But that person, I think, is living a life of moral and religious and spiritual blessing and should be applauded. You know, I think that's the question for me, is not what's your intellectual theology. It's what do you do with the questions that you're living, and what do you do with the suffering that you witness?
Rabbi Ariel Berger's book is called Witness, Lesson from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. We will see you in Rochester tomorrow, and I'm really grateful that you took the hour for us today. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you, all of you.
Rabbi Berger, yes, and our thanks as well to in-studio Stacy Fried, co-chair of the Rochester Jewish Book Festival. It's rjbf.org if you want to be there tomorrow night for Rabbi Berger's event or for any of the other events happening as part of the festival. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And a festival volunteer, Barbara Applebaum, who's going to be introducing Ariel Berger tomorrow night. Enjoy that, and thank you for your insight and time this hour. Short break, more connections coming up.